Buddhist Summer School, Saturday afternoon, 27th August 1977.
We have here a question, or rather I should say a request for an explanation. It runs thus, and it is a problem which all of us have to face now and again, quite often maybe, when we attempt to live mindfully. Often my mind feels dull, and it seems that the energy needed for mindfulness is missing. Can you give guidance? I think this is a good opportunity to learn how to distinguish between the use of the word mind and the brain. The mind as such is something universal. It is a particular kind of expression of the one primordial energy, which is the creative energy of itself. It is continuously creative. And this creativeness is non-repetitive. It does not produce the same form. We recognize types because, constituted as we are unable to do better. But every single pulse of the creative action in eternity of this creative pulse creates something entirely new. If one is capable of the Buddha eye, the third eye, one would be aware of this. But this awareness is practically impossible to put into words. This primordial energy has that aspect of it which we may call transcendent mind, universal. Transcending space-time, it is the instrument for forms, shapes, manifestation to appear. Out of original chaos, chaos in its true meaning, this primordial energy itself in the state of vibrant quiescence, this aspect which we call mind is the transcendent power which releases form, shape out of that mind. When the great religions of the world have talked of the thought in the mind of God, they have referred to this kind of thing. And you will find that in the Hellenistic presentation of the teachings of Hermes, God is referred to as All Father Mind. Buddhism is not the only religion which postulates mind as the supreme and identifies the word mind with the Buddha and with the Absolute. It's very interesting. Buddha, the enlightened one, the old man, if you like to put it in its concretest form, because in ancient times the old man of the village was the wise one. He was the man who had the experience, the knowledge, which was, so to say, the most valued in the village. The old man, Buddha. We have the modern Gujarati word, Buddha. You see? So, the enlightened one was equated with mind, this transcendent mind, and with the Absolute itself in Mahayana teaching. For example, Huang Po very definitely equates those three. So now, mind is this particular aspect of the original creative energy which is transcendent. As such, mind can never know dullness. The word dullness or any qualitative word we use cannot really apply to mind, especially if we equate it with the Absolute. It remains the immeasurable. It remains the non-descript. It cannot be described. Only a finite thing can be described. The infinite, the non-finite, negates description. It negates all measurement, all comparison, and therefore all separation. One may perhaps refer to it as the unitary wholeness of the totality. So now, when we say mind with respect to ourselves, it is sensible. I don't go any further. Admittedly, what I'm saying is what I am saying. It's an arbitrary presentation, if you like. We may refer to mind as unitary wholeness. It would be a sensible way of regarding it. Now that is never dull. It is an aspect of this primordial creative energy. How can that be dull? How can that get tired or feel sleepy or weary? Only the finite can feel sleepy. Isn't that so? And weary. Even metals experience fatigue. We now know in modern science what fatigue in a metal is, in a machine is. Now, the concretest expression of that mind in the psychophysical organism, which is called man in the ordinary sense, is the brain. The brain is the instrument of the mind. It is the point of contact for transcendent mind. In Hindu teaching, for instance, Shiva, the third person of the Trinity, who is the creator of the universe and the reabsorber of the universe in a continuous rhythmic pulsation. He is commonly described as destroyer, which is not perhaps the happiest word. He is the producer and the creator, figuratively expressed in the third person of the Hindu Trinity. Shiva's point of contact with man, as you find in the yoga philosophies and teachings, is the brain, the thousand-petaled lotus center, the chakra. You see? So the brain is of importance in that respect. Now the brain is the fundamental, the main root of what we may call psyche. The brain and the nervous system, the spinal column, they are the essential features, the essential physical constituents of the what we call the psyche. This energy mind, shapeless, formless, transcendent, interacting with this organism, touches it at that point. Now the physical organism can get tired. The brain can get tired. These are just electrochemical processes throughout the body. The vigilance center located somewhere there, you see, at the back of the brain. The vigilance center flags because of the accumulation of chemicals, and the power to keep your eyes open, wide awake as we say, begins to lessen. And you notice that your eyelids droop. And you also notice that the muscles of the neck begin to say, I really must stop now, I can't work anymore. And the head wants to fall forward and so forth. The eyes shut and you go off to sleep. When that happens, then chemical changes further, we'll call them generally physicochemical or electrochemical, which they are specifically, take place. The vigilance center is recharged, and up you get. Conscious again, as we say. Conscious in the psychophysical organism, which implies that all your sense organs now are active again, functioning. You can see, you can hear, you can touch and taste and smell. You can bring back to mind, as we call it, things in your memory and so forth. Now it is this brain which gets tired. And one feels dull. The brain's activity may also be inhibited from fulfilling its proper part in mindfulness, because something has cropped up, some memory has come back, some emotion, some fear or anxiety, whatever it may be, that has cropped up, some memory comes along, out of the well of the unconscious, as we call it, which really means some part of the brain, which the brain cells, which hold these impressions of the past, which are not in the forefront of the brain's activity. And they inhibit the action of the brain in acting, in continuing to be the proper instrument of mind. Now, in actual fact, the brain of the ordinary man is very, very rarely allowed to be the instrument for the functioning of pure mind in itself. Otherwise, thousands and millions of us could fairly easily be functioning at much profounder levels of consciousness all our lives, which we don't. We are caught up fundamentally with food, sex, and commerce. This is nature's trick to keep the particular species going. The higher centers, as we may call them, are asleep, and they are kept asleep through various influences. So when we turn to the religious life and begin to practice mindfulness, we are not yet sufficiently knowledgeable, sufficiently awake to what is implied, to what is the rationale of the process of mindfulness. It's a very deep, a very profound thing, very difficult to express in language lucidly. One may say a lot of things about it, but you can always put a question mark to what is said, and I hope you put question marks to everything that I say. Don't just swallow them. Now, when this happens and the brain begins to flag, try and keep aware of the fact that the state of sleepiness, drowsiness, torpor, dullness is present. Don't say, I am dull, I am sleepy or anything. There is sleepiness. This is the state of dullness, the state of torpor. And if you can let the rhythm of the breath be easy, flowing, there's no necessity to breathe deeply as such, but just your ordinary life rhythm going, fresh air and light sometimes help. Then you will find that that state passes away. But in the act of being aware that one seems to be unmindful, that in itself is mindfulness. Now you see, if we understand this, we will understand rather more deeply what is meant by being attentive in the religious context, in the religious sense of the word. Because being aware in this way prevents a complete cutting off, prevents the complete sort of shutting down of the lines of communication between mind in its reality, its transcendent state, from being in touch with the brain and influencing the organism. Now, when you know that, what are some of the consequences of it? You won't feel depressed. You will just know this is the passing phenomenon. And you will have an inner poise, spontaneously and naturally present, so that you won't feel depressed, you won't feel like saying, oh, this is too much for me, I can't do these things. I have practiced this for the last 40 years, 70 years, 125 years, and this is the result. I'm back on square one. Well, the best answer to that is, don't attempt to get out of square one. That is your square. That is your stance, your standing ground in relationship to life. If you want to get out of square one, you have a particular desire to get somewhere else. But life, the Lord God, if you like, has put you there, right? Be there. And be attentive then to the fact that you are there, to the fact that it seems as if you are not there for the time being. But that kind of attentiveness, that kind of mindfulness, you see, will keep the lines of communication more easily open. When the discipline has come to its fruition, as the Buddha said, done what there was to be done, this is the end of all jati, which they always say, this is the end of all birth and rebirth, of all jati, the conditioned state. It is a much freer and a better way of looking at it. When you see that, this is the end of the conditioned state. Because whatsoever the organism, whatsoever influence the organism may exert, and it is bound to exert its influence, because every organism produced by nature has its limitations with respect to its own functions and in relationship to transcendence. Otherwise we'd all be transcendence itself here now, just like that. Wouldn't we? But we are not. Even a Buddha suffers illness and death physically and so forth. Even he tells Ananda, especially towards the end of his life, Ananda, my back is aching, please fold up my robe into four parts and let me lie down. See, it's like that. So why should we be so childishly ambitious as to feel depressed or upset because one feels dull at some time or other? These are passing phenomena in the becoming process. Let them go. Observe to the best of your ability. Keep quiet and you'll be happy. So I think that is a practical, sensible way of understanding the situation. Mind in itself is never dull. It is the organism which does these things. And as one grows in the ability, the skill, the kusala kamma, the skilled action through the living of the discipline, as one grows that way, there will be less and less dullness, less and less depression, less and less what we commonly call failure in our effort to live the religious life, until the time comes when the whole of life is the religious life, the brahmacharya, the walking to Brahma in Brahma. This is the part we all forget. We tend to translate it as a walking to Brahma, as if Brahma is there, I am here, come on Brahma, I am going to come and see you, shake hands with me, and so forth. Oh no! Just stay on the square one that you are, and you'll discover that Brahma is you. Isn't it significant how the Buddha time and again says, and then Brahma Sahang Pati, the supreme Pati is Lord, Master, Husband. You see, Brahma, as this is Brahma as regarded as the Father God, the Creator God of things. He disappeared from his world and appeared before me. The Buddha just sat where he was. Tell that to a devout theist, and I don't think he'll feel much of a conscience if he bangs you on the head straight away for such blasphemy. I'm putting it in a frivolous form, but the Jews crucified Jesus when he admitted at the end. Caiaphas asks him, "Art thou the son of the blessed?" That was the term they used, the blessed, for Yahweh. They would not pronounce the sacred tetragrammaton, Yod, He, Vav, He. They wouldn't pronounce it, the holy name. They said, "The blessed." And Jesus simply said, "I am." And what was the consequence? You see? It's like that. One must live religiously, happily. Truly happily. And here again the Buddha shows the way remarkably well. When he talks of renunciation, in what sense does he talk of renunciation? Not as we commonly understand renouncing. Oh, now, oh, I've got a beautiful house and gardens, but I really must give it up. I must renounce it for the sake of the holy life. Why must I renounce it for the sake of the holy life? And like the natural born terminological inexactitude speaker, I say, oh, because I love God, for the sake of God. And the Lord God just sleeps and goes on snoring, utterly ignoring me, because I'm purely selfish. It's for my sake, that's all. I do it because it pleases me, because it gives my ego satisfaction. I made this wonderful sacrifice for the sake of the Lord. Then after I'm dead, they'll put up a lovely statue in that house and say, this was the man, etc., or a plaque, you know, commemorating his wonderful virtues. The virtue in the dualistic sphere, in the ambivalent sphere, which, if one is provoked sufficiently far, will burst out into the opposite vice with titanic force, because it's done in the name of God. Whatever you do in the name of God or in the name of the devil, it doesn't matter which, the reaction is always titanic. It's never small. So since we tend to fall down, better stay on the earth rather than climb to the 33rd floor. Ambition, out. All these subtle things in the psyche. So when the Buddha talks of renunciation, he presents it in such a way that the listener sees, but of course, this is the natural and simple thing, and it is the happy thing, that it is unnecessary. And when you really see deeply and inwardly, this is unnecessary, it falls off you, to put it in its rather more restricted form. To put it in a better form, it changes into a liberated psychical energy which is now purified and which will be useful for real good. This whole idea of transformation, of transmutation, is really a most valuable idea. Use it. You transform everything. Everything gets transformed. That is a better way of putting it. Don't say, I am going to transform this. It will get transformed. This is the nature of the becoming process. But you are the instrument, the medium through which that transformation can come about. So, when you come to the question of dullness and the energy needed for mindfulness you find missing, be aware that it is so. Be aware how and why it is so. It's the tiredness of the body. Let it rest. If it falls asleep, it falls asleep. Now, last night, those of you, I expect you all read the timetable which has been drawn up for you. When you go to bed, review the day. And I just gave the warning that if your review is going along happily and the body is relaxed and at ease, you will fall asleep long before you have finished reviewing the day. Did anyone fall asleep before reviewing the day? You see, the body is tired. It needs it. You mustn't drive it. One mustn't estimate the body in the wrong way. Nor must one overestimate the body. But remember that the great religious teachers, the Buddha amongst them, did say that the human body is an essential instrument for the fulfillment of the purpose of our human existence, the liberation of the Uttara Purisho, the further man, the Jivan Mukta, as they said in India. the disciple who was a who became a true saint in the real sense of the word, as the theistic religions have put it. Without the body, no such thing can happen. All right. I think it might be useful to spend a little time understanding this word Dhamma, Sanskrit Dharma. Its root is Dhri, the Sanskrit root of the word Dharma, or the Pali Dhamma, is Dhri, meaning to uphold. Use that meaning. You will find that the most instructive meaning for Dhri, to uphold. What is it that one upholds? Bear in mind that out of the primordial chaos, which is not used in its secondary meaning of disorder, but of vibrant quiescence, that's the original chaos, unmanifested, there emerges cosmos by virtue of self constriction. You may ask, well, what makes you say that? How do you know? Well, my first answer will be, I don't know. But just consider it as presented in this way. By virtue of self-constriction, and this first self-constriction arises through what we in our terms and our very restricted mode of expression may call the desire to know oneself. The attempt to answer a question which arises, who am I, what am I? Now, in the asking of that question, there arises simultaneously the situation where there has to be a search. Who am I? What am I? You're going to search for the answer to this. But if you're in the state of search because you have desired to know something or do something or whatever it is, then you have produced a separation. If, just try and imagine it, if you are the totality itself, well, you are the totality. There is nothing to interfere with the absoluteness of that totality. But if that totality were to say, well, who am I, what am I, wants to know itself, then it has to produce something else, something other than, in order to make a search. Otherwise there's no search. There is nothing to search. So the desire to know oneself is perhaps the power that brings about self-constriction. This is not original to me, please. Way back in the Rig Veda, the famous creation hymn of the 10th book the hymn number 120, which is called the creation hymn. You see, you look at the creation hymn. It's like in the first two verses are a little bit like the first verses of Genesis. And then it goes on. Therein arose desire, karma. Karma, desire is a correct translation, but karma also represents eros. Not eros as related to the word erotic, which is a secondary or tertiary aspect of it. Eros, karma, is this creative action producing the universe. Producing what then? Cosmos out of chaos. Now, once having produced cosmos out of chaos, its maintenance in time and space comes into being. The activity of maintenance. This activity of maintenance is the activity which we call the order of the universe, the divine order of things, as theistic philosophies put it. The divine order. And man, you and I, as created beings, are part and parcel of this cosmos. We easily slip into the state of chaos in our mind, in our brains particularly. We are in a state of chaos all the time. Just watch the brain process. Be mindful of the brain process and see what a tumult, what a chaos it is. You see? But our task is to uphold this fundamental order of the cosmos, what is called in Sanskrit Ritta. R-I-T-A, but it's, forget the I, it's R with a dot underneath. It's the vowel sound in the Sanskrit alphabet, Ritta, you see? The fundamental order of the cosmos. And this power, it is a power, this power which holds the cosmos together as such is inherent in every manifested thing in the entire cosmos. From a single atom to a star to a galaxy and so forth. And if we fulfill our particular function rightly, in our life here and now, in our situation and circumstance, we are upholding the cosmic order. We are carrying out the will of the gods. The gods, or you can call them Dhyani Buddhas if you like, you can call them archangels if you like, anything you like. They are the main archetypal expressions of this primordial creative energy. You see? And it is that order which we are maintaining. But in order to do this, the organism must be fit to do it. Because as and when you or I attempt to live the religious life, and develop our sensitivities, we make ourselves more and more open to these archetypal forces. We are in touch with the gods, but if we are in touch with the gods, we are also in touch with their opposite numbers, the demons. Don't think of demons in the sense of sheer devilishness. No, no. They are the constructive and commonly called destructive, but better to regard them as the transformative forces at work. They don't allow anything to remain a fixation, because the moment there is a fixation, it becomes an obstacle to the rhythmic movement and functioning of the entire cosmic order. You see? Therefore, the Buddha taught, grasp at nothing, not even the profoundest states of consciousness. So now, when we, through our growing sensitivities, open the doors within the organism, we allow our own dormant faculties, these profounder faculties, and these subtler energies to become the channels through which the universal cosmic forces flow in. So, that is one of the reasons why meditation or any sort of discipline in any department of life, serious discipline, brings about considerable distress often, illness, perplexity, upset, and all the rest of it. But don't be frightened. Don't bother about it. Don't care about all that with the wrong type of caring. When such situations arise, remember Sri Krishna's words, "Thy business is with the action only, not with the fruits of action." If we concern ourselves with the fruits of action, then woe betides us. How do we be entirely concerned with the action in itself? Through sheer mindfulness. That kind of attentiveness which keeps the channels open between brain and mind as such. And then that acts as a protective influence, a saving force. They have been represented in the various religious philosophies as guardian angels and so on. So now, it is this kind of upholding which is, as far as I can see, the profound meaning of the word Dhamma. You uphold the cosmic order. Now, this cosmic order is the law of the being of things and persons. It is the law of their being. That is why the Dhamma is sometimes translated as law. Now, the understanding by the brain, the grasping by the intellect of this, produces concepts which are expressed, of course, in language. And that becomes the doctrine, the teaching, which is the Dhamma. The conceptual verbal expression of what is conveyed to you, the whole being, through your developed sensitivities. The conceptual verbal expression of that is the doctrine. You see? Now, in this connection, remember a very important point. We read the texts, the concepts expressed in words, and we say, oh yes, I know the doctrine. Not at all. When I read something, there is an interpretative activity which goes on in my own brain, not in the mind so much, but as in my own brain. And that interpretative activity is heavily conditioned by my natural evolution, I mean evolution through nature's process, what we call the conditioned reflexes and all the rest of it, and so forth and so forth, as well as by our socio-cultural heritage, which fixes for us the forms of understanding. This is where our great limitation comes in. That is how our sankhara, as they are called, come into being. This superposition, superposing our socio-cultural evolution in the form of concepts and ideas and fixed ideas. This is the truth. There is no other. So you see, when I read anything, according to the extent to which my brain has been conditioned and the manner in which it has been conditioned by my particular socio-cultural heritage, interprets what I read. But what am I doing actually? I'm only forming certain mental constructs of my own through the use of a conditioned, limited brain. And I say, I know the Dhamma, the teaching. I don't. Simple proof, if you like. When I was 10, and I used to read all these things, in my teens, I thought, oh, I know now all this. I read the Upanishads, and I read this, and I read the other, and swallowed it all greedily, the greediness of a very grasping intellect. You see, I thought I was very learned. In my 20s, I discovered that, oh, no, that wasn't quite right. Now I know the truth. In my 30s, oh, no, that wasn't quite right. Now I know the truth. Till fortunately I've come to the position where now I do know that I don't know. That is what I mean when I say I don't know. People think, oh, he's a modest man. I'm not at all modest, nor am I immodest. At least I trust I behave in a manner which shows that I'm not immodest. You see? It's like that. So one then becomes truly open-minded, empty-minded. And when, as they put in the texts, when the mind, they say mind, but it's more the psyche, is void, completely void of all its fixations, the quality of fixation, when that is the case, the psyche is utterly transparent. It is transparent, it is empty, and it allows mind in its transcendent reality to function through. When that happens, that person, as the Buddha said of himself, is a speaker of the truth. Because the words and the concepts which he presents in the immediate now, in that particular situation, to the particular people present, is the supreme thing that can happen under those conditions. This is the meaning of truth in the religious context. So the doctrine comes into being, and Dhamma means doctrine in that sense of the word. Now, the word Dhamma could also mean to be right, to be correct, but without being righteous. In the second volume of the Majjhima, page 27, you find the phrase Sila va no cha sila mayo. To be right without being righteous. That is the Dhamma. Which you could regard also as being true to oneself. If you are true to yourself, you are right, but there is no righteousness in the wrong meaning, the pejorative meaning of the word righteousness. There is a worthy meaning to righteousness too. In Zarathustrian teaching you find righteousness as such, presented as one of the great powers of Ahura Mazda himself, one of the seven archangels. You see? Righteousness, Asha, which also means purity, also means duty, and so forth. So, Dhamma also means truth in the religious sense, to be right. We would commonly say in everyday parlance, accurate, exact. And when we say that, we mean that the words we use are the exact correspondence representing the object or person or event described. The two tally completely. You see? So Dhamma could also mean that. The Buddha said that he, the Tathagata, is Dhamma Bhuta, Bhuta become, the embodied Dhamma. I am the truth, said Jesus, said Krishna, said Zarathustra, said the Buddha, all of them. What a wonderful day if and when you and I can say, I am the truth. Those fateful words, An al Haq. Who was the Muslim who said that and was crucified? Fancy, I knew his name so well. Sorry, forgotten. An al Haq, he said, and the Muslims wouldn't have it. He said to them, if you do not recognize God as truth, then at least recognize one of his signs. And he said, An al Haq, I am that sign. I am that sign. They crucified him very cruelly. So the Buddha said he is Dhamma Bhuta, And he also said, who sees me sees Dhamma. Who sees Dhamma sees me, the enlightened one.